This podcast doesn't do commercials for a number of reasons that you'll hear me discuss if you listen long enough. But if you want to support this work, feel free to click on the link at the bottom of most podcatchers that says support the show. Half of everything donated goes to addicted people, people struggling with homelessness, and people who are struggling to get out of prison and back on their feet. Enjoy the show.
This is it then. The big time. The main line. The high point of every drug addict's existence. Of every thousand hypes who ride the toboggan to hell, only a few ever get on. The outfit that he uses is the drug addict's only friend. With it, he can exist in his living hell until the next fix. To prepare the venom for his bloodstream, he empties heroin onto the spoon. Every grain is precious and cannot be spilled or wasted.
Welcome, this is the Dr. Junkie Show, and I am your host, Ben Boyce, doctor of communication, prison educator, and a man with his fair share of track marks still visible on my arms. Today's episode is about shooting up and other rituals of use. I want to start this episode with a trigger warning, which is not usual for me, because you usually know what you're going to get with a show called Dr. Junkie. If you're surprised when drugs come up, you probably clicked on the wrong podcast. But today's a little bit different, because I'm going to go right at things that might make you want to use your substance of choice, because that's how humans are wired up. It might already be happening just because I mentioned it exists. If you still use your drug of choice, or if you aren't worried about urges to relapse, then listen on, duly warned. But one thing I never want to do with this project is cause somebody to drop the ball on their journey of recovery, whatever that means for them. So if you feel like you're still in a fragile spot where you're concerned about using, mark this episode as for later and come back when you're up for a discussion about rituals of use. One more thing, this show does not offer medical advice. I'm not that kind of doctor. The war on drugs is designed in a way that ensures the permanent existence of dangerous, overpriced drugs, violent underworld markets, environmental disasters related to manufacturing processes, and poverty at every step of the way, from the grower to the manufacturer to the consumer, with only a few folks ever getting rich. But it's also designed to create a lot of issues which are much harder to spot, issues we tend to just blame on users unless we know better. I remember my first shot like it was yesterday. I'd been in the hospital with a broken pelvis, the result of pulling out in front of somebody on my way to the dope man's house. And after being discharged, I wanted some heroin. The prescription they'd given me at the hospital just wasn't cutting it. This was the first time since the crash that I'd been healthy enough to visit my girlfriend's house. It'd been almost a month, and she was a steady user too, so I called her up and asked if she had any dope. She told me to sit tight and that she'd head over to pick me up. And when she got there, she had an odd look on her face, like she was hiding some sort of surprise. We drove back to her place and headed up to the bedroom, where she pulled out a white tin, the kind with a little lid that flips up. It probably had candy or toys in it at some point when it left the factory, but now it had become a makeshift container for paraphernalia. Spoons, balls of cotton, matches, and a bag of half-inch 31-gauge hypodermic syringes. Underneath all of that, there were two packs of heroin. Now by this point, I'd been using heroin, fentanyl, and Oxycontin regularly for a couple of years. I was dependent by all accounts, and I'd been using opioids regularly for even longer than that. Even though I'd never shot up, I knew what I was looking at. I grew up in the United States, land of Hollywood misrepresentations. I'd seen a kit like this one hundreds of times before, from Pulp Fiction to Basketball Diaries, and all that Hollywood crap had done its work. But I had no idea what to actually do with the kit. My girlfriend, let's just call her Lilith, she started pulling out equipment, and I realized she'd done this more than once already. That was the surprise, I guess. She'd started shooting up while I was in the hospital. Oddly, or maybe not, her experience made me feel safer, so I sat back as she put together a shot. We were using white powder heroin. The only real difference between it and the black tar you get west of the Mississippi River is purity. Powder heroin is usually refined an additional step, which makes it easier to inject than black tar heroin. Black tar is exactly what it sounds like, a sticky, tarry ball of yuck, and it often requires additional preparation, including acids, to get it to dissolve. Our powdered dope would dissolve in water. Lilith took out a pack of heroin, the corner of a lotto ticket folded into the shape of a tiny envelope, and she opened it, dumping the minuscule pile of tan powder into a spoon. She added some water, not a lot, but enough to cover the powder, and I watched it turn into a yellowish liquid with small chunks in the bottom. Then she added heat. The lighter she used had to be held at the perfect distance from the spoon. Too far away and it wouldn't transfer enough heat. Somewhere in the middle and it might get too hot and boil all the dope into a char. Too close and it would cover the works with soot. And again, it appeared she'd done this a few times, because it only took her a couple seconds to elicit that telltale hiss that signals the concoction is fully cooked. The room smelled amazing, like earthy tea. I peeked down into the spoon before she went any further, and noticed that the chunks in the bottom of the mixture were gone, now mixed in. Lilith ripped a small piece of cotton from a cotton ball, rolled it in between her finger and her thumb, and then dropped it into the mix. Next was the needles. She reached down into the tin and pulled out a bag of hypodermics, removing a new one and popping the orange cap off the top before pressing the point into the wet cotton ball, which had now become a filter. My heart was racing. It's funny, I remember my anticipation as vividly as anything else from that day. For nearly 5 minutes, I'd been watching with growing excitement, and as the needle began to fill, I was reminded of my early days snorting dope, of the excitement that shows up during the hunt, while you're tracking down and preparing the drugs, crushing the oxy, pouring the drink, lighting the pipe. It was all right there in my mind. I was back to that place I didn't think I could go anymore, that spot where romance and newness is still alive and well, and where the sad truth of addiction in the United States hasn't yet driven us to numb depression. Lilith hadn't even shot up, and we were both already high. Next came injection, which was always a challenge for Lilith. She had small veins, and they were hidden beneath her skin, unlike mine, which bulge all the time, a feature that would come in handy as my addiction progressed in coming months. But Lilith, she had to wrap a belt around her upper arm and tighten it so much that it left a bruise. She kept bending her elbow back and forth, like they do in the movies, trying to get a vein to pop to the surface. And then she started stabbing. Months later, when we were shooting up all day every day, there were nights when Lilith would spend hours trying desperately to find a vein, poking around in her arm and searching for blood to shoot backwards into the needle, a sign that you've hit a blood vessel. And all the while, I'm sitting there, already injected, sometimes even coming down, and she still hasn't gotten high. I could always just tighten up my arm muscles and nail a vein, no problem. But Lilith always dealt with this issue. She was patient, delicately pulling back the plunger, creating a vacuum that would suck the blood up the second she hit the vein. And then the game began, up and down, left and right, poking around and stabbing until, yes, blood. Oh wait, it slipped out again, and then back to searching. This time was lucky, and she took less than a minute to find her mark. I don't remember this struggle ever described in any of the anti-drug PSAs I saw as a kid. I imagine it would have elicited too much empathy in the viewer. Lilith found her mark and plunged the drugs home, then pulled out the needle and laid back on the bed, eyes flittering with a satisfied groan. She was too high to mix up my shot, so I started copying what I had just seen her do. I dumped another pack into the spoon. I added a bit of water and then I heated. I dropped a personalized filter into the mix and then I drew it all up into a new needle. As I finished, Lilith sat up. The drugs had worn off enough for her to re-engage. Then it was my turn. It was much easier than I thought it would be. The needle was new, so it slid right in without that painful pop that I'd get used to later on, as needles would dull but I couldn't get new ones to replace them, sometimes because I just couldn't afford the $5 for a new bag, but other times because pharmacists actually refused to sell them to me. It was that sort of thing, being turned away by self-righteous pharmacists, that eventually grew into this podcast. Eventually my needle found its mark and my blood blossomed into that mushroom cloud. I pushed the plunger down and then removed the needle as the drugs kicked in. It's not what you think, injecting heroin? I'm not saying it's a light beer or anything like that, but it's not what they show you on TV. In Trainspotting, injecting heroin appears to weigh you down. An overdose actually pressed the main character into the floor. Pretty clever camera work. In Traffic, injecting heroin caused Erica Christensen's character to slide into drowsy, intoxicated giggles. In Gridlocked, injecting heroin nearly killed Cookie, and it turned two other characters, played by Tim Roth and Tupac, into a moral confused criminals. But it's not like any of that. One of my biggest takeaways from that day was a sort of disappointment that it wasn't something more than what it was. I'd been snorting oxys and smoking fentanyl for years, and I didn't get higher that day than ever before, not by a long shot. I didn't find some buzz that I hadn't known or experienced some portion of my brain which before had been blocked off to me. It was disappointing in terms of thinking I was going to the promised land, only to arrive in a very familiar space. But I did get really high on a super small amount compared to what I normally had to use. I typically needed a pack to get well, two to get high, and three or four to blast off. That's almost $100. But now that I'd shot it up, with just one pack, I was suddenly high as hell. And here's my first point of digression. Shooting up is dangerous compared to other methods of drug consumption for the obvious reason that you don't have any wiggle room in your dose. When you swallow a drug, it slowly absorbs through your stomach and liver, and a large percentage of it, sometimes more than half, is digested and never affects us at all. If we take too much of a drug orally, we sometimes puke it up, a survival mechanism the body uses to keep us alive. When we smoke fentanyl instead of eating it or injecting it, we adjust the size of our dose automatically because our lungs will only hold what our lungs will hold. But when we inject a drug, we dump the entire dose directly into the bloodstream, no takebacks. The reason people shoot up is almost always money. It would have cost me around $100 a day to get well at the height of my addiction, and around $200 to have a party day on heroin, and more like $500 if I really wanted to do some damage, say I wanted to use cocaine that day. But if instead of snorting these drugs, I injected them, I could spend a day incredibly stoned and spend, say, $100. That's a terrifying realization. We live in a world where heroin, cocaine, MDMA, fentanyl, all of it, it's incredibly easy and cheap to produce. Heroin and cocaine cost around $1 a gram to manufacture. That's more than most addicted people could use in a day. But that same gram cost hundreds of times that amount on the streets, funding underworld drug dealers and forcing users who would otherwise choose safer methods of consumption to instead inject their drugs. That's the only reason we're in our current so-called opioid epidemic. It isn't the drugs, it's the market. Digression concluded. So I laid there for a minute or two, enjoying the feeling of just being okay, the real experience of heroin and other opioids for those of us that become addicted to them. If you don't use heroin, or if you've tried Vicodin but don't really like it, or if codeine makes you feel like, eh, take it or leave it, that's not because you're stronger than those of us who struggle with addiction or dependency, which are not the same thing. It just means that you're wired up differently than we are. When addicted people get high, sure, we sometimes really blast off and zone all the way out. We nod. Drugs are indeed a great trick for getting rid of recurring thoughts or depression because they do in fact change how we feel. Immediately sometimes. But beneath the buzz that sometimes hits hard and other times is hardly noticeable, depending on the dose, there's a medicating benefit that many of us don't recognize until we try a drug like Suboxone or Methadone or some other long half-life maintenance drug. There's a sense of being in this world that most addicted people can only describe with words like uncomfortable, rough, itchy, anxious. Medicating allows us to get past that, whether the drug we use is legal or illegal, methadone or heroin. That's what we're medicating, that itchy feeling. Yeah, sure, the buzz is nice too. It feels like love for those who haven't experienced it. But what most of us come for is the relief from whatever just isn't right. Our anxiety, our edginess, for me, my Asperger's, OCD, all kinds of stuff. I think that people who don't use drugs often fail to realize just how lucky they are to have bodies that don't demand these things. Some of us just aren't that lucky. That's how I felt that day. Relieved. I planned on the single pack not really doing much for me, perhaps bumping my level of anxiety and ickiness down a notch. But instead, I'd found that well-medicated, lubed-up, happy-to-be-alive feeling that so often evaded me. And I never looked back. I want to digress again here and talk about rituals of use, the real point of this podcast. All that stuff I just described, the sights and sounds of the tin, the smell of the dope, the sound of the sizzling in the spoon, the images of laying out cotton balls, needles, all of that is part of my ritual of use. And as you probably noticed throughout the retelling of this story, I got high way before any of the drugs actually hit my system. Sure, the drugs were a particular piece of the experience, very unique in their effects, but the process is always set in motion by tolerance and sensitization, which begin long before we actually take the drug. My body recognized clues from my environment that hinted at an upcoming dose of heroin, and it began to do what humans do, adjust my biology based on those predictions to prepare for a dose. I love Vegas. I know, digression on digression, but stay with me. I paid the bills during part of my PhD by traveling back and forth to Vegas and picking up ATVs which I could bring back to Colorado and sell for a small profit. But when it was time to go to Vegas, or when it is time, because I still go there quite a bit, something changes in my body. And just like with drugs, it happens way before I actually get there. It's in the airport at the terminal. It's in the plane as it comes in for a landing and I catch a glimpse of the city skyline. It's that feeling of walking the strip. Cigarettes, the ding of slot machines, the scent of air fresheners used by casinos to make the process even stickier. It's all part of what creates that feeling of Vegas. It isn't just the slot machines and the go-go dancers. And it happens before we actually get there. It's the same thing with drugs. The processes that lead to addiction are no different than what the rest of the world goes through every day. We learn what to expect by doing something repeatedly, whether that means driving to work, visiting a restaurant, heading to Vegas, or shooting dope. The more often I shot up in a particular space, the more the things in that space became associated with shooting dope. My body would begin to adjust as soon as I walked in, because my brain saw that space as connected to getting high, as part of my rituals of use. But hold on, because if the tolerance process begins with rituals of use, and it does, then what does that say about our culture of prohibition, which makes sure that addicted people are trapped all day long, every day, in a loop of constant use? We're always hustling up enough cash for a fix, or tracking down a dealer, or finding a way to meet them, or hiding the dope as we transport it back to the place where we plan to use it. All of this is before we actually start the in-home process of getting high. And we get caught in these use cycles day after day. When you're addicted, it's hard to think about anything else. Our bodies are prediction machines, and there's a clue here that's ignored in public policy, because it clearly points to the value of spaces like safe use sites and the importance of legal pharmaceutical supplies. Right now, if you want dope, you'll have to do what I just described. And you'd better keep your guard up the whole time, because your actions are illegal at every step of the way. Hypervigilance means hyperreaction, because when you pay close attention to everything, you notice more which requires a reaction. Your body will remain in high alert, excitement over getting high mode through the entire process, and probably even after you use, depending on where you are and how dangerous it is to get caught. You might devote hours to a single hit, running around town to areas which you also come to associate with drug use, making turns onto streets which become familiar in the same way. We wind up spending our days in a haze of drug-activated rituals. Of course, in such a state, addictions grow from small side jobs into full-time careers. We've made sure it works this way. After you get your drugs, you'll probably hide while you use them, because goodness gracious, you don't want to get caught doing this naughty thing, you naughty person. Another emotion which tends to drive these processes yet deeper, shame. And while you're keeping an eye out, you'll also come to associate whatever space you're in with getting high. Everything becomes associated with drug use in a culture of prohibition. And because of that, We live in a culture where addicted people struggle with activated urges decades after we stop using drugs altogether sometimes, because we cross paths with so many spaces and places that remind us of that biological process. Now imagine how this could work. What if, instead of all that stuff I just listed, drug users associated sterile clinics where licensed doctors wrote prescriptions for drugs to people who want them, and where those people are constantly offered treatment, counseling, and other medical services? That's it. Now every time you think about using, you're likely to think about counseling, about a doctor's office, about a safe space with people who care about you, about a 15-minute stop and then back to real life instead of an all-day mission to stay well. Where users used to spend hours tracking down and transporting our dope, instead we'll spend minutes in safe, legal businesses full of people whose main job is helping drug users get and remain healthy. The concerns over spending money would evaporate, because once we legitimize such clinics, insurance, and presumably even public services, would likely pay for them. They save so much money on incarceration, EMT services, police interventions, and social workers that they more than pay for themselves in the long run. But not unless we first care about the people who would be most helped by this sort of policy. In a system like that, the want-fueled rush of ritual would be minimized and contained in the best place it could possibly live, treatment centers packed with legit doctors and counselors. And of course, the bonus, drug dealers on the streets and the cartels that they support would be out of business overnight. That little tidbit usually pulls a lot of weight, even with the firmest anti-drug people I talk to. There's even more benefits. The overdose situation right now, where the CDC is saying 100,000 people died from drug overdoses last year alone in the United States, that could be almost entirely stopped. The reason we opioid users overdose and die is twofold. One, our drugs are garbage cut with unpredictable doses of fentanyls. And when we consume 100 times more dope than we meant to in a single shot, we often overdose so fast that we don't even feel it coming. But that problem is made much worse by problem number two. We're hiding when we use because we aren't allowed to use. Legally, socially, religiously, we're considered immoral, contagious sinners. We lie about our use and force it to grow into a monster before anyone finds out, usually because everything falls apart. And when we do overdose, it often happens with nobody around. So in situations where we could be easily revived, we just die. All of this is avoidable. The safe use sites, which were allowed to open in New York a few weeks before I recorded this episode, have already saved almost 100 people who would otherwise have died from an overdose. Those folks were saved just because they were there. These sites aren't enough, but they are a great first step to building a world where drug users and addicted people are not set up for failure and death. If you don't carry Narcan and you have insurance, or you live in a city where you can get Narcan, please pick some up. Keep it handy. Give it away to somebody who can use it. Until we provide safe places for people to use legal, safe, regulated drugs, this crisis is going to continue. And you never know when you'll cross paths with someone who needs it. Either because they're overdosing right now, or because they live in a world where they don't have access to it themselves. That's the real solution to this crisis, compassion. I totally understand that it's hard to have friends who use drugs. It's hard to have any friends as we get older, especially in our current digital post-COVID world. But that doesn't mean we can't regulate use. Open clinics where empathetic professionals deal with those people that we all care about, but sometimes can't stand to be around. Those of us on the tail end of a 4-day coke binge or a meth drag, or those of us detoxing from benzos, opioids, or alcohol, or those of us desperately trying to find these substances. Socially, we can have our cake and eat it too, and probably save a ton of money in the process. Love yourselves and the addicted people in your life. I'm Ben Boyce.
Caution, intelligence, normal defenses go up in pot smoke. Hank is a real hype, a hooked mainliner beyond hope. He is long past getting any kicks from marijuana. His body is conditioned to heroin, one of the most powerful, dangerous drugs known to man. So dangerous that its importation, even for medical uses, has been banned in the United States since 1925. Every day, the cost of his habit rises. $80, $90, $100 a day and more. Every day, he must have increasing amounts of the drug. To get it, he will lie, steal, murder, even trap the innocent. The outfit that he uses is the drug addict's only friend. With it, he can exist in his living hell until the next fix. Without it, he will suffer the unbearable tortures of withdrawal from the drug. To prepare the venom for his bloodstream, he empties heroin onto the spoon. Every grain is precious and cannot be spilled or wasted. A few drops of water are added to make a solution. Then the small wad of cotton, usually dirty, is placed on the spoon to serve as a filter. The solution is then drawn through the cotton filter and into the needle. This cotton is saved and used again and again. For if the addict is ever caught without the drug, he can cook the cottons and squeeze out a small amount. This is it then, the big time, the main line, the high point of every drug addict's existence. Of every thousand hikes who ride the toboggan to hell, only a few ever get off.